Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2, The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we are talking about some serious issues, from food waste and childhood hunger and what chefs can do about it, to education, food, and how it can all come together on one local farm. We'll talk with Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine about attending the recent James Beard Foundation Food Conference in New York City, and about how experts from other industries, such as fashion, had plenty of advice for those in the food biz. Ryan also tells us about the Beard Foundation's boot camp for policy and change that he attended this past spring, and how that event aims to empower chefs to be more effective advocates. We'll also revisit an interview from earlier this fall with Andrew Distelrath and Ashley Shuffelbarger about the school at Distelrath Farms, an unusual school in Indianapolis that enrolls students from pre-K through high school. We'll hear about how the nature-based school came to be, and how Andrew has created a curriculum that allows students to actually help manage the farm. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Chefs seem to have a much higher profile these days than they used to, and as they become well-known in their communities, many are speaking out about food issues, everything from food waste and childhood nutrition to agricultural policy and environmental concerns. Indianapolis chef Ryan Nelson is among those chefs lending his voice to advocate for change. Ryan was selected to attend the recent James Beard Foundation Food Conference in New York City, where chefs and others in the food industry had a chance to learn from those in such disparate fields as technology and fashion. Ryan tells us what the conference was like and what a chef from Indianapolis can learn from the fashion industry.
Yeah, I attended a conference in western Montana with about 15 other chefs, and the James Beard Foundation hosts these boot camps across the country and kind of bring chefs together, and they talk about each boot camp is around a single issue, and the issue that I was there for was food waste.
Okay. Very, very appropriate for a chef.
For sure. And the conference basically started off with the stat that 40% of the food that's produced in this country is wasted.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is the most shameful thing in the world.
Right.
And you think that, like, maybe it's transportation. Maybe it's from the farm to the grocery store to the restaurant. Like, things are lost or spoiled along the way. And that, like, represents just a minuscule amount of the waste. When in reality, the waste really occurs in homes and in restaurants.
What we throw away.
What we throw away. There isn't a set way or a regulated way countrywide of dating food.
Sure.
So, like in the state of Montana, milk has to be thrown away after 14 days, even though pasteurized milk can last up to like 26 or 28 days.
Oh my goodness. So right there is a huge amount of waste.
Yes. And a lot of these things, it's so common sense that if you change like the dating on something, or if you allowed things to be donated, like there's laws against donating that milk to a food shelf, where it would make a huge difference if
they just could.
Yeah.
Right. So now how does this, how did the bringing up these topics impact you as a chef? So, you had some time to process that. What was the result of that boot camp for you?
Well, I think when you're confronted with a statistic like that, that's so large that it's shameful, and it is an inspiration to act and to like find out what else is out there. And immediately, we looked at like what we did at the restaurant. We looked at our portion size. We looked in our compost bin. And first of all, like how many restaurants compost?
Well, that was my point. I was going to say that, you have a compost bin, right?
But yeah, we look at what we're throwing away and we're looking at like, do we need to be throwing that away? Like, can those, carrot tops be something? Can those radish or turnip tops be something? Can, we do something with the leftover bread? But also like I'm known for putting a lot of food on the plate. Like, am I putting too much food on the plate? Are people finishing their entrees?
Well, now that's a question to ask, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. So I literally spend some time like kind of digging through the trash and spending some time in the dish pit during service, something that I never do.
Right.
It has the benefit of, it's found money in a way. Like, if you're putting less out there, or if you're salvaging something or reusing it or repurposing it, you know, it's going to affect your food costs in a positive way. But it's also, you're not putting, you know, six big bins of trash out every night. You're putting, you know, three or four. So that's the first place I looked, was just at the restaurant. And then obviously at our home too, like, do we need to make so much?
Right. And you know, I'm terrible about, you know, buying things and then they get stuffed away in a crisper drawer where they don't get crisp. They just get squishy and then they get thrown away, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I guess just seeing that statistic of 40%, and then when you look at like how many people in this country are actually hungry, and like, I'm also a little bit ashamed that I didn't know like the extent that, I mean, I realize that hunger exists and that, you know, people struggle, but there's 40 million people in this country that are food insecure.
Again, a shameful statistic.
We're the richest country in the history of the world. It's not that we don't have the product. It's not that we don't have it. We just lack the, you know, political will to change things. And, you know, I'm willing to do, you know, I don't know, whatever I can in my small part of this to hopefully, you know, change that.
Now, how did you get involved in the boot camp? Was it something you had to apply for, or how did that work?
I applied years ago, and
interesting.
Yeah, it was. I've been always a fan of the James Beard Foundation, and fortunate enough to cook there a few times over the years. And I applied years ago, and they were looking for someone from this part of the country to represent, you know,
the Midwest.
The Midwest, uh-huh. Yeah. And I guess my application stood out enough, and I went to the boot camp and. Made some great friends and made some great connections, and I guess made enough of an impression that I was invited for the food conference.
Now, tell me, before we go into the food conference, what else happened at the boot camp? What, you know, what went on? It was over several days.
It was a day and a half, and literally every moment of our day from 7 o'clock in the morning until like 1 o'clock in the evening was spoken for. Which was great. We were a captive audience, and they only had us for a short amount of time, so we made the best of it. But they gave us some advocacy training as far as, like, you know, if you're in a room, like, we have elected officials that eat in our restaurants.
Of course.
And if you have a moment with them, you can say, you know, hey, like, what do you feel about this, or how do you vote on this? And there actually are scorecards out there where you can see where your elected officials, where they rank on food issues.
Okay.
And
right. So that's some good,
it usually falls along,
right?
Party lines, but sometimes it doesn't. But that's the thing that also struck me as kind of interesting, is a lot of these things, a lot of these changes that can be made are kind of that they should be bipartisan.
Oh, sure.
And they should be. They are common sense changes, like changing the labeling on some milk so you're not throwing away good milk. I mean, who can't get behind that?
Right.
So there's a lot of that. There's like, how do you approach somebody in your community, or how do you approach one of your elected officials? And we did role playing, and we did a lot of like back and forth. And the people that facilitated the meeting, one of the guys, his name is Michelle Nishan. He has a company called Wholesome Wave that basically increases, like, people that are on SNAP benefits can mm-hmm. go to a farmer's market and they get double the amount of product at a local farmer's market. And this guy's written parts of the Farm Bill, and all these people have this like great background in like in, you know, how to lobby on behalf of, you know, hunger relief or mm-hmm. you know, people that have those issues.
Now, is that a sort of an unusual role for chefs? I feel like you're getting more and more out in front of the public, and so maybe this is a natural progression.
I think that chefs are leaders in their community. I think that we're pretty visible, and I think that. You know, our story is an easy one to tell. And I mean, we're associated with food, and a lot of times, some of us are looked upon as experts in the food
sure.
industry.
Sure. So. Well, now I would imagine that chefs are typically very cognizant about food waste in their restaurants when it comes to what you use and you know, what you can make use of on your end.
Sure. I think that you can always do more. I think that you can always find, you know, we use as much as we can of everything that comes in the door. but the nature of our society and how things are presented and how we live. We're a wasteful society. And you can say nose to tail, and you can say, you know, that you use everything. But, I mean, do you truly use?
Good point.
Yeah.
Right. We've been talking with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine. Stay with us for more from Ryan here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Becoming an effective advocate for change isn't necessarily easy, especially for chefs who are more often in the kitchen than out in front of an audience discussing the need for new legislation or social policy. But as chefs have become more well-known, many have begun to lend their voices to causes facing the food industry. And the annual James Beard Foundation Boot Camp for Policy and Change aims to help chefs do just that. Indianapolis Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine attended the boot camp this past spring, and he tells us what it was like and why he found the intensive training so helpful.
The first night was a reception at the James Beard House, and it's an old brownstone in Greenwich Village that used to be James Beard's home.
Right.
And his kitchen is tiny.
Now, you cooked there, right? So that's a notoriously tiny kitchen, right?
It hasn't gotten bigger since I cooked there. I think the last dinner I did there was in 2006. They've made a few adjustments, but it's quite small. It's laughably small, but it's cozy and it's fun, and it's an honor. It's a huge honor to be able to cook there. He has a nice garden out in the back. Like his bathroom is in place, his shower is still there. Elements of it,
right,
that are like a home.
Uh-huh.
Some of the offices for the James Beard Foundation are located there as well.
So this is where the conference took place?
No, it was just a reception on the first night.
Okay.
And Susan Ungaro and Chris Moon and Mitchell Davis and kind of the head people of the foundation were there, and along with some of the attendants of the conference. So, you know, some wine, some appetizers, and a couple hours, you know, mingling and making small talk at the
beer
house.
So that's a nice way to kick that off. So what did the conference entail?
The next day, it was a full day in one of the convention centers in New York, and it was a list of people that are related to the food industry, not necessarily directly related, but they had people from outside of the industry, fashion people. Technology, philanthropists, social movement people, business, and kind of how their careers or how their day could be, you know, connected to the food industry and to trends. That was the big talking point was the trends within the food movement.
Right. Now the fashion connection is interesting. Who did you have speaking from that angle?
Tim Gunn, who was on Project Runway.
Well,
he was kind of the MC. And
that's very interesting for a food conference.
Yeah, he was incredibly articulate and kind of went into depth about the couture houses in Paris and how the old guard changed to the new guard and how that relates to food and how what's celebrated in kitchens now is different than what was celebrated, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, and how things change.
Now, that's very interesting, because things are really changing, you know. So what sort of things are changing from your perspective?
Well, I think in many ways that, you know, fine dining has kind of fallen by the wayside, and that we have a much more casual approach to dining. And I think that people that are younger have an even more casual approach to dining. So like what's celebrated is different than what was celebrated before. Gone are the white tablecloth restaurants.
Right.
You know, those are rare now. And that sort of formal service where everything is just much more casual now, much more approachable.
And what about technology? You mentioned that as a part of the conference.
I would say that the thing that we talked about with technology was there's this scale, this hype cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Gartner's work on hype cycle, it's a company that talked about how items have an awareness trigger, and
okay,
then they get excitement. There's a peak of enthusiasm, and then there's a trough of disillusionment where things kind of fall out of favor. And then maybe they come back into the fold, and they call it the slope of enlightenment. and then eventually it becomes mainstream.
Oh, that's interesting. I bet you see a real connection there with food.
Yes, and they had we had like a workshop kind of event where we at our tables we were in assigned seats, and there was people from kind of all walks of life and all parts of the country too, which was interesting. And you take something like cronuts. You know, like cronuts
right.
show up on the scene.
Right, the croissant donut combination yeah. people got all wound up about.
2 weeks later, they're in Japan. And like a month later, they're at Dunkin' Donuts. And then,
right.
you know, like you kind of like map out where are they on the cycle. Or another one is like the canvas, like kind of bags that you get at the grocery store.
Oh, sure. Right.
Where, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we were all getting, you know, plastic bags or paper bags. And now they've kind of gone through this cycle where they're just like mainstream. And
right.
we had like a whole list of items that we went through, like GMOs or community supported agriculture or sustainable seafood or quinoa, like
right.
all these items, and we kind of like mapped them out, and it was really cool to see that like people from different parts of the country had them on different parts of the scale.
Oh, I suppose so. So if you were in New York, maybe your awareness of quinoa peaked some time ago, and perhaps another part of the country, it maybe just now on the upswing or something.
Yeah. So we kind of looked at these like trends throughout our industry and talked about them on a national level with, you know, other people. And it was really, really fascinating.
So it seems like there was less input from chefs on the program than people from outside the industry.
Yeah, there was probably a couple hundred people at the conference, and I think there was only, maybe 10 or 15 chefs there. So there was a lot of like food writers or people from academia or, farmers. There was
sure.
people from all over.
Now, it seems like that might be, very inspiring, as a chef. I know that you tend to get a little bit of tunnel vision and focus just on your restaurant and the work you're doing. Was that sort of, enlightening and uplifting?
Oh, 100%. And that's something that I definitely suffer from. My wife makes fun of me all the time that I live in like this, my own little world. And I defend that like, well, at least it's a world of my own creation.
Right.
But like, yeah, I'm
Your
stuck in my kitchen
right?
and like I go to home and I go to work and I go back and forth and that's really about it. And then to like be kind of thrust into this with chefs and educators and people from around the country. And seeing what they're going through or what their struggles are, what they bring to the plate is super inspiring. And there's a whole big world outside of, my kitchen.
Now, what do you see coming down the road, as far as some trends that we can be aware of, kind of based on some of the stuff you saw at the conference?
There was one of the themes that kind of went through through fashion and through technology and through food and through popular culture is that everyone seemed to be in the agreement that things start on the West Coast and very quickly they go to New York and
right.
to the rest of the East Coast. And then after that, they kind of trickle through the rest of the country. And that was one of those themes that got brought up several times that people just accepted as true. Like
mm-hmm.
it starts on the West Coast, goes to New York, and then the rest of the country gets it. So it was funny. We were talking at the Beard House and one of the chefs, she was from Denver, and she was talking about like doing some tip sharing, and
mm-hmm.
we were discussing like the ins and outs of that, and like if it's legal, and like how would you go about it?
Right.
And somebody was like, "Well, Ryan, what do you think?" And I was like, "Well, living in Indiana, like I get the benefit of watching you guys kind of figure it out before me." And like
right?
we all kind of laugh, but it's really true.
It is right. So you can see what other people are doing or have done.
Yes.
So. Are there some things that that you can take away from the conference and apply here, as to what you do in your restaurants or in here in Indianapolis?
Definitely. I think the thing that stuck with me the most was sort of like there were several people that were honored at the Leadership Awards, which were a part of the conference as well. They had a nice dinner and they gave away these James Beard Foundation Leadership Awards. It was at the Hearst Tower on Columbus Circle. It was just this gorgeous setup and like our view was, skyscrapers at night. And the people that were honored were from all kind of walks of the industry. One of them had started the Black Farmers Association. Another one were two guys that worked with these migrant workers in South Florida that basically changed the whole tomato picking industry in Florida.
Wow.
And there was a congressman that was honored from Massachusetts who's done a lot to end hunger. End Hunger Now is his kind of pet project. His name is Jim McGovern, and I think that's what probably stuck with me the most is the hunger aspect of the hunger mm-hmm. relief and what I've been inspired to get involved with going forward.
Well, you know, we might not see hunger, you know, right in front of us all the time, you know, living in Marion County or Hamilton County, but it's there, right?
Yeah, definitely. When I got back, I looked up some numbers, and I live in Fishers, and I looked up Hamilton County stats, and there's 28,000 people that in the richest county in Indiana that are food insecure, and 14% of those 28,000 are children.
Oh.
And it's just mind-boggling that, like, so many, you know, struggle with that. And it is hidden. It is something you don't think about. You know it exists, but when you see those numbers, and nationally it's 40 million people that are food insecure, and we have the food, we have the means, you know, we just need the political will to change how things, you know, work in this country to, you know, feed our own people.
We've been talking with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine in Indianapolis. For more information on Ryan and his restaurants, go to lateharvestkitchen.com and thenorthendbbq.com. Okay, I admit it. It's a little early to be talking about Christmas. I mean, I still have leftover Halloween candy in an orange bowl by my front door, and there are still pumpkins on my porch and gauzy ghosts hanging out in a tree in the yard. It always takes a while for me to take my Halloween decorations down, so you know it's going to take some time before I haul up the red and green bins from the basement and get a wreath hung on the door, so really, I am not rushing the season. And then, of course, there's Thanksgiving in a few weeks. As someone recently posted on Twitter, there is a whole holiday devoted to pie in between Halloween and Christmas, and it should not be glossed over. Which is true. I love Thanksgiving, a holiday that's focused on cooking a big meal for family and friends and then eating pie and watching a little football until we all doze off. Well, that's a great holiday as far as I'm concerned. And then there's all the leftovers the next day, which I look forward to as well. So, you know, I'm not out there on Black Friday filling my cart with door-busting deals. I like to soak up one holiday before moving on to the next, which is why I'm still nibbling on a fun-size Almond Joy Halloween leftover right now. But I have to point out that time does tend to race by, and that before you know it, there'll be snow on the ground and Christmas music playing on the grocery store Muzak. So, even though it might seem like I'm rushing the season, I want to talk Christmas cookies. Or, rather, I want to talk about a Christmas cookie contest. Here's the thing. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio and WFYI are holding a cookie contest, and I'd love for you to enter. You know you have a favorite Christmas cookie, whether it's gingerbread men or those little powdered sugar-covered Mexican wedding cakes or something minty and chocolatey, or even those bright green marshmallow cornflake cookies with the red hots that are supposed to look like holly berries. Those and other holiday favorites are all awesome cookies, and I know they show up on holiday cookie plates and at cookie exchanges, and I want some of those favorites to be a part of our WFYI and Eat Drink Indie Christmas Cookie Contest. So look through your recipe box and find your favorite holiday cookie, one that really captures the taste of the season, and send it to eatdrinkindie@gmail.com. We'll sort through the entries and choose some recipes that seem to really capture the taste of the season. We'll line up some judges, taste some cookies, and choose some favorites. And I hope we'll get to hear from some winners here on Eat Drink Indie Radio as well. So find your favorite Christmas cookie recipe and email them to eatdrinkindie@gmail.com. And by early December, we'll have a winner with plenty of time for holiday baking. And now, back to November and those Thanksgiving pies. We talk a lot about restaurants and dining here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, but the importance of local food goes way beyond what's on our plates. Local food, how it's raised, and where it's raised, can play a role in education as well. We've seen a growing number of schools that incorporate gardens and even caring for animals into their curriculum. But one Indianapolis school has taken that even further. The school at Distelrath Farms, which enrolls students from preschool through high school, is located on a 7.5-acre working farm on the southeast side of Indianapolis, and the farm and school are intertwined. I talked with founder and curriculum director Andrew Distelrath about how he came to open a school based on running a farm and the lessons students learn there, everything from writing and math to big issues of life and death.
So my background is in education. I've taught in a variety of different programs across the country. And my wife is also an educator by training. And as it became time for us to start our family, we spent more time looking at our options. We knew from our own experience some things that we wanted and didn't want. And as we explored different potential schools for our girls, we became increasingly frustrated with truly a lack of options. I mean, we talk about school choice and we talk about there being options out there, but for the most part, it's putting lipstick on a pig.
As far as what's available out there, you know, with the public, private, charter, that sort of thing?
Yeah, for the most part, very similar things are going on in all those classrooms. You know, even a lot of the schools who are doing gardening programs, there's not a whole lot of productive work going on with those gardening programs. I mean, for the most part, what I've seen is you've got an adult running a garden, and you have some students who come out and do a little bit of show and tell. And that's cool, and that's great, but we're missing so much. Again, it's a paradigm. Now we're talking about this at the teacher and the administrator and the educational system standpoint. I mean, it's we view our job as educators in general in this society. We view our job as educators as bringing children into our classroom and disseminating information to them. And where we differ is, we view ourselves as facilitators of this experience that is called childhood.
Where did you start out as an educator? In a traditional setting, or has it always been this kind of thing?
Initially, working with at-risk youth in Indiana, and it was a fairly differentiated technique that I was taught, a lot more about behavior management before we get to the academics, and the academics were very very high energy and a lot more fluff. It was more about teaching these kids how to control themselves in society. Then from there, spent some time in the public education system in a charter school, teaching U.S. history, and so that was a much more formal setting, pros and cons there. Spent some time in a juvenile detention facility, which was a wilderness therapy program, which it was designed to be very project-based and experiential, and I saw some of the very real limitations they ran into there. And I've worked with a variety of schools here in Indianapolis and a couple in Michigan.
So how? What did you want to do differently?
Number one, relationships. We wanted, the biggest thing that we want for our girls is for them not to just be a number, not to fall through the cracks. That's what we want for our students here. In order to do that, the very first thing we do is we shrink the ratio. That's incredibly hard to do. It's expensive to do. We're still working on how to do that.
The student-teacher ratio,
that's
you mean?
Correct. Yep, student-teacher ratio. So, and what having that smaller ratio allows us to do is focus on the individual needs of the student. That's one of our biggest philosophies here, is that each student is on their own individual educational path. And we as educators, part of our role is to differentiate for the needs and the passions of those individual students. And you can't do that with 30 kids. You can't do that when you're responsible for 30 kids in a classroom, or when you're seeing 120 kids a day, you know. Even 20 kids is a lot. So we bring that ratio down. Then we make sure that we are capitalizing on the teachable moments that life presents, and that the things that we are teaching are relevant and applicable and in context. And when we start to do those things, when those become the priority, as opposed to, I've got to teach this, this, and this because we've got the standardized test coming up, when we shift our priorities, the environment, the education shifts significantly. We see a very, very different interaction with learning from these students. They take much more ownership in their education. We were talking about it earlier. A lot of times they don't even realize that they're learning. It's learning is this natural byproduct of the things that we do, and it's not until we actually stop and evaluate and process what we just did that we're like, oh wow, oh wow. And that to me is what is how learning should be. Not all the time, but a lot of the time, it's we're learning by doing. We're learning by living life. Most of us as adults, we know that the vast majority of what we need to know for our occupation, we learn on-the-job training. So why in the world are we spending the first 20 years of our lives stuck in a classroom in order to prepare for, air quotes, the real world?
Why a farm setting to do that?
There are so many life lessons that occur inherently as a part of living on a farm that it's things that, again, we don't have to artificially recreate these things. A couple big but very important examples, life and death, sexuality, and reproduction. I mean, those are difficult, huge concepts that typically are glossed over in a traditional educational setting, but they're very real. They are life. They're some of the biggest issues that we deal with. So we processed pigs a couple of weeks ago. Excuse me. So that is, we took life. We took life from those animals, and that the students interacted with that and different ways. Some of them it was very difficult, some of them it was no big deal, and both of those reactions lead to follow-up discussion and follow-up conversation, and the next time that life is taken, there's likely a very different interaction in one way or another, a very different response from that student. Just as we all evolve in our interactions with death throughout our lives, we evolve in our understanding of what death is and means, which then evolves our understanding of what life is and means. Life to me is so short and so precious. I don't want my children and I don't want our students spending their very precious childhood cooped up in an artificial setting, staring at a desk or at a teacher all day.
We've been talking with Andrew Distelrath of the school at Distelrath Farms. Stay with us for more on the farm-based school here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking with Andrew Distelrath of the school at Distelrath Farms in Indianapolis. The school enrolls students from preschool through high school, and all of the learning is connected to running the farm. Andrew explains how learning coincides with launching a farm market, and instructor and program director Ashley Shuffelbarger explains how she incorporates writing into the curriculum.
So I can easily see, you know, the big picture lessons. How about, you know, the more, I don't know what you might call mundane lessons, you know, the multiplication drills, the, you know, the parts of a sentence, the grammar, the, I don't know, the physics, the foreign language, that sort of thing.
So we deal with all of those in different ways. Excuse me. I'll give you a current example that we're working on. So the students are just working on getting the Monday student market going. Well, this is a very long-term project. This will be going on for years. And throughout this project, there is the planning ahead that needs to be done. What is this setting going to look like? You know, where are we selling? What are we selling? There's the planning of the customer interactions and the spiel. Then there is the real customer interaction and the social skills that go along with that. There is math involved as we're pricing the items, as we're making change, as we're reconciling the books. There is, and again, that's all very real world. You're dealing with money. I mean, we're dealing with decimals in one of the few ways in adult life that we actually deal with decimals, which is using money. Then there is the construction of a new sales building that needs to go along with that. So there's the planning and preparing for that, creating our materials list, going out and purchasing those materials. Then there's an incredible amount of measuring and cutting that goes on with that. So there's your mixed numbers and your fractions. Well, then there's the business planning that takes place this winter. There's the marketing. I mean, the kids are working on signs right now, road signs right now, which some of the students working on those signs that go by the road, for our emerging writers, they're practicing bringing those stencils out, tracing the letters in the way that a letter actually should look. You know, so that's a fairly rote practice, similar to a worksheet, but it's applicable. They get to go out and see their sign by the road.
That's right. They have something to show for it once it's done.
It's purposeful. It's not just rote. Our older students, they're not just tracing the letters. They're understanding the purpose behind this work, and working on their diligence with it. That's just that one project. You know, Ashley works with the students on a monthly newsletter, and so there's an incredible amount of language arts involved in that. That's where we focus a lot on the grammar and sentence structure, writing style, and all of our projects, just like most of the things that we do in life, involve, you know, the academics don't neatly divide themselves between language arts and math and science. They overlap and they blend. And so all of our projects incorporate some aspect of the varying traditional academics. We do our best to fill in the gaps as we see them arise. You know, just like in parenthood, you do your best to raise your children balanced and with all of your varying goals in play at all times. And the reality is you don't do that. And you're sitting at the dinner table or you're watching your kids interact at some point and you're like, huh, looks like we need to spend a little bit more time on that. And that's how we approach school as well. We recognize, you know, we'll be working on various projects and then we'll recognize some very serious weaknesses. And then we shift our strategy a little bit in order to spend more time and focus on those weaknesses.
Well, Ashley, tell me a little bit about the sort of language arts component in learning on a farm. So you might not imagine, you know, a lot of language arts projects, but I'm guessing that I'm just not seeing them.
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to equate language arts with a farm. I came here as a creative writer. I write poetry, and I think that it's such a natural part of being in the outdoors. You're connecting with something inside yourself, and writing is just part of being an effective communicator. So I think that's what I'm trying to teach more than anything to the students, is developing a voice, written and oral, that is effective in communication with the outside world. And so when we work on our newsletter each month, the students, they're looking at sentence structure. They're looking at proper usage of grammar, because that all goes into effective communication. If you write a sloppy sentence, somebody on the other end isn't going to understand it, right? But beyond that, we're developing unique styles. So the students have full reign over that newsletter. They decide how they would like to interact with our audience. And now we have talks about, well, so if this is, if our audience would be families who are interested in attending the school, then what kind of tone should we have with those families? If they're families who are already connected with the school, is that tone different from the tone that we were just talking about? And so they're thinking about those really intricate and complex pieces of communication, and they're really building on those and growing from those month to month.
And you're also working in, you know, I would imagine, you know, the more, you know, the computer skills, you know, that, you know, of course they live in a digital world, right. You know, and so they have to be able to participate.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'd say, even though I grew up in a technological world, when I was in high school, I didn't learn how to use primary tools that you use in the business world. So I didn't know how to use social media to boost posts for particular purposes. I didn't know how to write an effective email to a professional. I didn't know how to use MailChimp or any kind of web platform that would allow me to create my own site. And now there are some specialized classes like that, but yeah, that's definitely a big part. And it's sort of outside of the farm world, and yet we're connecting it with the farm world because we're talking about our school and the farm here. And so that's how we've kind of bridged the gap there.
We've been talking with Andrew Distelrath and Ashley Shuffelbarger of the school at Distelrath Farms. We'll be back with more on the school, including details on when you can visit the farm and shop the new market, here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are talking today about the connection between food and education. Specifically about how one local school has created an entire curriculum that's focused on farming. The school at Distelrath Farms in Indianapolis now enrolls about 30 students from preschool through high school, and founder and curriculum director Andrew Distelrath tells us how the school got started, how he combines farming with education, and how you can visit.
When my wife and I were living in Houston, we were getting ready to start our family, and we knew we wanted to move closer back to home. Her family's from Indianapolis, and I'm originally from Michigan, so we compromised. And we knew that my career path was to start a school, to lead a school, and we spent some time discussing what that would look like and how that would come to be. And, you know, as we continued talking, we realized that we definitely wanted farming and agriculture to be a part of that, not only for the educational value, but we wanted to have good quality food for our family. So it was, you know, two pieces on that. And we knew that we wanted space enough to have a farm, but we wanted the cultural mecca, so to speak. And Indianapolis is one of the few cities that offer both of those. You know, we're 7 miles from downtown. My wife works right down on Circle Center, and she can bike there in 25 minutes. And we've got 7.5 acres here, and pigs and goats, and we've had cattle, and so it's a pretty we're inside the loop, you know. I mean, it's a pretty fortunate situation we find ourselves in, to be able to have a place like this.
Now, when did you start? Did you purchase the farm first? Did you develop the school first? How did that come about?
So we bought the property. It was just a big soybean field in 2010, and spent the first couple years just learning lots and lots about how to grow food.
Did you have a farming background yourself?
Not so much. Not so much. I've driven by farms. I've always loved the outdoors, and I did spend a little bit of time working on farms, but it was large farms. You know, I mean, I was driving tractors and doing maintenance and stuff. It was not small scale farming, intensive small scale farming like we're doing now. A lot of reading. A lot of visiting other places.
Are there models for this?
There are models for various aspects of what we're doing. Yeah, I mean, we're not inventing anything new here. We're just combining different pieces, different, you know, we're mining little gold nuggets from all these different organizations, and we combine those here, and we're trying to offer the best of what others are doing without the constraints that others are subjected to. So the farm started first in order to we needed to learn a little bit about what we were doing. And then while we've been kind of honing our agricultural technique a bit and getting the various enterprises up and rolling, also having student groups and doing different programming out here on the farm, and working with some different schools in town to help develop some agricultural programming with them. We brought some high schoolers out here last fall in August, and they spent half a year working with us, Ashley and I, kind of getting our feet wet in the curriculum development side, and the students helping us work to develop the infrastructure to start the preschool and early ed program this May of 2016. And we are just now starting our third quarter with the preschool and early elementary as well. So expanding that middle school, high school group, expanding that preschool and early elementary. And our goal for this winter is to fill out the wait list so then in the spring we can split those groups in half and continue from there. That's the growth model. We've got a lot of overlapping broad age ranges in our different groups right now, which is really neat. It's really fun to work with those different age groups. But it's a lot of fun. It's also extremely difficult.
Now, how many students do you have?
I think enrollment is at 33 right now. So approximately 18 to 20 students each day. We've got a handful of full-time students who are here Monday through Friday. Most of our students are here 2 to 3 days a week, and then they supplement either in a different program, or most of our students are homeschooled to supplement with the more traditional academics.
Well, I was wondering, you know, where your students come from, and if you're focused on a particular type of student.
We are continuing to determine and fine-tune our niche. When we started, we thought we were after 100% full-time students, and we're finding that that's not really what the community wants. The homeschool community is our largest audience right now. We didn't realize that when we started. So we have one student who is here 2 days a week, and then her other 3 days she's with the charter school. We're talking with another school right now about a student who is looking at something similar. So we're really hoping to bridge that gap between our private non-traditional entity and the public general mass educational system. It'd be great to be able to bridge some gaps there and help provide this type of environment to students who are in a more traditional setting. But right now, our primary audience is the homeschool community, and they are looking for, supplemental character development and skills building for their kids.
Now, as far as I see, you know, you have the shop. You're obviously, you know, raising produce. What do you do with that? Is there a connection to the community? Can they come see what you're doing? Can they come shop here?
On Saturdays, the public's always welcome, 8 to 4. We backed off agricultural production quite a bit this year in order to focus on getting the school rolling. And then that becomes a big part of our winter curriculum, is designing the various agricultural enterprises that we'll put forth next year. So I really can't tell you exactly what we'll have to offer next year. We try to have it, the sales are secondary to our own personal consumption. So we want varying and healthy nutritional foods for our families, for our students, and then we capitalize on the ones that can make us a little bit of money as well. So right now, if people want to come visit, you can jump online or shoot us an email at distalwrathfarms@gmail.com, or you can jump on our website, distalwrathfarms.com, and get in touch with us to schedule a visit, or you can come to the market on Mondays from 1 to 4, or you can come check us out on Saturdays from 8 to 4. Saturdays can't guarantee you personalized attention. There's always a lot going on, but if you want to bring the kids out and walk around and check out the animals and feed them some bread, you are more than welcome to do that.
We've been talking with Andrew Distalwrath of the school at Distalwrath Farms in Indianapolis. For more information on the farm and school, check out distalwrathfarms.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in today for our conversations about food and education-related issues. And thanks also to our guests, Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine, and Andrew Distalwrath and Ashley Shuffelbarger of the school at Distalwrath Farms in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.